أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم everybody and welcome to another episode of the Poets of the Household podcast where we sit down and we discuss poetry regarding our Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his holy household. And usually we talk about saying that this episode is going to be special and that episode is going to be special. However, this really is going to be a special episode, alhamdulillah. Typically, you know, the term is thrown around, you know, so-and-so individual needs no introduction. However, I think today is very appropriate to that. And we are humbled and we are honored to have our guest, whom Nucky in a minute will give an introduction. Again, he doesn't need one, but out of respect and out of honor, we will be giving one just so everyone knows the impact of his work in regards to poetry as a whole and his poetry when it comes to the Ahlul Bayt, inshallah. Naqi, I'm joined by you as always with your beautiful background and your beautiful coffee machine in the background, whom we are lucky to do with ziyarat during this episode. How are you doing, Naqi? You doing okay?
Alhamdulillah, everything is good. You know, the weather is great outside, but that also means like allergy season is in full bloom. So it's like a nice juxtaposition of wanting to be outside, but also being destroyed by it because of the allergies.
Oh, yeah. You were like sneezing the other day, weren't you? You were sick a little bit.
I got bad allergies.
Oh, boy. All right. I hope you feel better. As mentioned, Naqi, why don't you take it away and introduce our guest?
We have the honor of Brother Tahir Adil joining us today. And like Brother Abbas mentioned, needs no introduction. But I think he does deserve this introduction, just like Brother Abbas said, to know the impact of his work. So Brother Tahir Adil is a British Bahraini poet and a spoken word artist. He holds an MA in creative writing and poetry from the University of East Anglia. He has served as a judge for the Stephen Spencer Poetry Prize and was appointed the poet in residence of Wells Next to Sea in 2019. His literary contributions include titles such as I Don't Know What Language I Dream In, The Names, The Chosen Names, and The Divine Names. And beyond his books, Adil's works have been showcased in various esteemed publications and platforms, including Ambit, Smoke Magazine, The New European, Gulf Daily News, Glassworks Magazine, TEDx, BBC Radio 4, Poetry London Magazine and Poetry Salzburg Magazine. Review. So as you can
just to name a few.
So we know how big of an impact Brother Tahir has had on the poetry scene, and we are honored to have him today.
MashaAllah. Brother Tahir, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. How are you doing?
Alaikum assalam. I'm doing well. Honored to be among two beautiful, incredible poets that I've had the honor of witnessing their growth and development as poets of the household. And it's also an honor to be on the podcast, which is something that branched out of those ideas, which is pioneering, to say the least. We've never had such a platform, let alone a podcast. So I'm happy to have these discussions and looking forward to it. I've had many discussions with Sayyid Nakhbi over the past year. So like him, I'm riddled away with allergies, but we've had poetic discussions all that time.
Yeah, mashallah. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule for being with us today. Literally, it is really, really an honor for you to be with us here today. So let's get started with the conversation. I'm sure a lot of our listeners are dying to know what's inside the brain of Brother Tahir. So, you know, typically, you know, before we get into a conversation, let's start this way, Naqi. Usually we end the podcast with a poem, but I think it might be appropriate, and Brother Tahir, I don't know if I'm putting you on the spot right now, but I hope you have some pieces prepared. But let's start off this podcast with a poem of yours, if that's possible.
Well, that's a brilliant idea. And that way, we could end the podcast really quickly. But, you know, I think the best and most fitting poem for this discussion would be a poem titled Karbala's Poets.
MashaAllah.
A poet must love wildly or use the broken pieces of his heart as a sharpened quill. for ink to spill beautifully into words that his tongue cannot untwist, unless he has the gift of Karbala, ready to be repotted into new vessels, ready to be rewritten as fresh wounds. For this is the season of sowing seeds, planting metaphors and similes until the clash of swords becomes ink, slaughtering the innocence of the paper. Until there is no room left, until the pots run dry and the poet must send his dying pen to the flowing river of his tear ducts for one last verse, only to come back empty. The pen drops, and so does the flag. And this is where the poet gives in. For the next line is where Hussein refills eternity with his own kin. And this part cannot be rewritten, for no heart can shoulder the burden of lifting your child like a perfect rhyme, only to have his throat pierced mid-lullaby. Now the poet looks to his hands, stained with ink, and promises to rewrite the same story all over again. And that is the
Ahsant.
Karbala's poets.
Ahsant, Ahsant, mashallah, mashallah, Allahu Akbar.
Beautiful poem.
What a picture that you drew with your words, alhamdulillah. I mean, Karbala is always an inspiration for us, and we draw a lot of, and that's the beauty of Karbala. Yeah, Karbala has many angles, but when it comes to the poetic world, it has such a gift that it's given us that we are able to, I mean, first of all, we have so many ahadith when it comes to writing poetry for the Ahlul Bayt and doing the dhikr of the Ahlul Bayt. And alhamdulillah, we have Karbala in such a way where we can put pen to paper when it comes to letting our emotions flow. And, you know, alhamdulillah, we couldn't ask for a better start to this podcast. Just the imagery, the metaphors that you utilized, it keeps the listener attentive from first word to last word. So mashallah, thank you so much. And that was I'm glad that we started the podcast that way. That was a great way that we were able to flip the script, as they say, and start the podcast in such a strong way. So thank you for sharing that, Brother Tahir. We might ask you at the end as well, just to sandwich this podcast with the poem.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I don't mind. I'll yeah. I've got
inshallah. There you go. There you go. So yeah, let's get started with the conversation. So typically, you know, the guests that we have here on our podcast in the past, they all come from an Eastern background, regardless of where you're from, whether it's from the Middle East, South Asia, anywhere. So, you know, we belong to an Eastern culture. Like our parents came to the Western part of the world, whether it's Europe or North America. And then we grew up in this culture and this upbringing of the Western world. So ideally, you know, we learn the English language. So in your experience, Brother Tahir, being of mashallah, Bahraini background, Arab background, and being a master of English poetry, in your opinion, what makes English poetry unique compared to Eastern poetry?
Oh, that's a loaded question. I need to choose my words carefully here. I was on BBC Radio about a year ago when I referred to the English language as a baby language. And this was a 7 a.m. interview on live radio. And I, you know, as soon as that interview was done, Twitter was full of hate. I was receiving hate left, right, center. Because I didn't select my words carefully. So I think there needs to be some sort of context, disclaimers, and an explanation before we get into the uniqueness of the English language and English poetry in general. So like you said, a lot of us come from different backgrounds with languages that are deep and rich in vocabulary, you know, literary history, lingual devices, poetic devices per se. And in comparison, English is a language in its infancy, be it because of how old it is, but also because of its nature as well. It doesn't necessarily mean the English language is inferior, because for me, I think is superior in a couple of different ways, which we'll get into in a bit. But it is a language still developing, whereas you have civilizations that have informed other languages, produce, bodies of work that have spanned centuries. So naturally, they would have a head start. So that's what I should have said on radio instead of calling it a baby language. But what does how why is English a unique language? Because of its malleable qualities. English has something I think other languages don't have. It has the ability to evolve more readily, and that's because of its infancy. It has the ability to take in segments, entire, learning from other languages and adapt it into its own kind of corpus throughout time, naturally, organically. And it enables a writer to also create these macro evolutions himself within his own lifetime. And that is something I've never seen in another language. That's why you get the Japanese, the Chinese, Hindi, Urdu, Farsi, Arabic. They have very rigid, if we go back into poetry, rigid poetic structures and forms. And that is because you have this kind of complex machine for thousands of years, for centuries, harnessing, perfecting that language and the poetry of that language, and the prose. So now people cannot break out of those structures. Naturally, when we come from those backgrounds, we try to bring in, transition, and migrate some of that culture organically. And our intentions are pure. But that's where the difficulty lies, is how much of a migration of language do you do? But that's the beauty of English, is that you can potentially help and be part of the revolution of the language. We've seen it happen with different poets across time. The Romantic era is something I always allude to, is because you went from poetry that is kind of very mechanical to poetry that is, alive with metaphor. And that's a whole, 100-year revolution. And that happened because of a few Romantic era poets. And that was something that was unheard of. But at the time, again, English as a language accommodated for it, and the people were receptive as well. They allowed the poets to flourish and build these devices within the English language. And I hope I haven't complicated things, because I can go on
No, no.
days, and I know we've got limited time. But that is why I think English, despite its inferiority right now, has the ability to change and to grow and to be, a malleable, moldable piece of literature for the writer himself and for the community around him. And that makes it superior in that aspect.
That's a beautiful way of putting it. And I mean, a lot of, when we talk about poetry, comparatively to the East, we always see English as inferior. But mashallah, you were able to present it in such a way that actually, no, English has its own beauty. And we've always talked about that as well, that every language has its own beauty. Like mashallah, Arabic, for example, is the language of Allah. And although I'm not fluent in Arabic, we come from a South Asian background, Indo-Pak, and Urdu is our main language. But I can say, Arabic is probably more rich than Urdu. However, Urdu language has its own beauty. And when our forefathers migrated to India, and then we started getting the Urdu poets, it's not like they were saying, no, let's just keep it at Arabic or Farsi. They said, no, let's introduce Urdu poetry. And we're lucky, as like Naki and I and our circle, we're very lucky because our attachment to the religion, our love of the Ahlul Bayt, was through poetry. And if our forefathers did not introduce this, then I don't know where we would be. So English is kind of going through the same thing, I believe, in regards to finding its own beauty and finding its own language and finding its own space, especially when it comes to the Ahlul Bayt, and it's finding its own space in this universe of poetry, mashallah. Naki, go
Yeah.
ahead.
And I guess, like, branching off of what you just said there, Abbas Bhai, like, Brother Tahir, you're one of the trailblazers, I would say, when it comes to, like, writing English poetry for the Ahlul Bayt. One of the first few ones that at least I remember in my lifetime, seeing your poetry coming out. So you've been in a position where you've kind of introduced English poetry to your community, right? Which is mainly probably a crowd that's used to listening to poetry recited in Arabic or Persian or Urdu, other Eastern languages. And then you've also mentored many upcoming poets as well. So you have that background where you've seen some of the challenges that new poets are that fa new poets face in regards to English poetry. Where do you see for someone who has an Eastern background, whether they be listening to poetry and trying to appreciate it or trying to write poetry themselves, where do you see the biggest challenges for someone with an Eastern background when they're coming to approach English poetry? Where is that challenge, do you think?
From what I've observed and experienced from my own experiences is that aspect of learning and unlearning. When I say unlearning is we have the advantage over other poets and other writers within the English sphere, where we have the inspiration, which perhaps in abundance, which they perhaps don't receive on the same level. And we also have the cultural heritage and the lingual heritage, which a lot of English speaking poets don't have. But it's also a hindrance in the sense that we allow this culture to seep in and this inspiration to seep in, and we don't put a leash on it and we don't control it. Which then again, this is all about the migration of language. If you allow one superior language to kind of supersede an inferior or a language in its infancy, it takes over, eventually creating kind of a subsidiary form of poetry, which isn't necessarily top quality, because now you've created this new entity that won't really live for long. Whereas English is the home of the poetry that you are creating if you are creating that in English. So you need to find a home for that piece of poetry. And that's where most people struggle with is they want to harness that experience, but don't know how. And that's why, for me, I always tell, upcoming poets or poets that want to develop their craft is consider mastering the English language, because once you're able to master English poetry, you're able to break free out of English poetry and begin to innovate. And then you can bring in, the cultural, lingual aspects of, your own heritage. And that is the biggest struggle. So it's both, a blessing and a curse at the same time. And I've seen it with Arabic, poets of Arabic background in particular, where there is a certain type of recital, lyrical poetry, the equivalent of a nuha, and people then replicate that form naturally and bring it into English poetry. But because of the syllable constraints that they've put themselves under, that begins to kind of wither away the meaning and the depth of their English poetry. And that's why I say, there is room for that. But there is also room for growth beyond that. So it's understanding where to draw the line when it comes to those influences that you bring in from your own language and culture. But it all stems down to mastering the language that you're speaking and writing in. Not to write within that scope or write in that manner, but in order for you to break out of it, like previous poets in previous eras, where they're able to now break out of it, whether it's through imagery or through poetic devices, where it's introducing new elements that are common in perhaps Urdu or Arabic, and introducing them in a way where there is a legacy, there is an immortality that you've created by introducing it in such a subtle way. So understanding that is very important. And I always, that is the piece of advice, is finding out how best to perfect your craft in the English language before adding elements from other languages. Even though there's a massive temptation to improve or innovate from the very beginning.
That's exactly how it should be. Whenever we read books on poetry and any sort of book you recite, like just simple basic books or something that's, you know, more deeper or complex, the first chapter is always language. They talk about language, mastering the English language and knowing the English language. So in regards to that, you know, in regards to language, how can we best embark, I would say, on the journey to master that English language and to ultimately master the English poetry? Like in your, like, I guess I want to come inside your mind, like, you, this is what you studied, you know, creative writing and poetry. And, you know, what was the best way for you? Like, well, how did you start the journey? And, you know, what was kind of your process to master the English language and master the English poetry ultimately?
I think observing and reading other poets and understanding where change has happened. I've had this discussion a number of times. Is what most people do is they pick up a book of poetry and it's set 500 years ago, and then they and back then that was, you know, the peak of poetry. But then rethinking that is a standard. That's a standard that is fluid. Poetry in the English language is fluid, unlike Arabic, which doesn't really change. So you could grab a poet from the, you know, the pre-Islamic Jahiliyyah period and show him a piece of work from somebody that is writing in Fusha right now, and the similarities, as long as they're using the same form, are quite stark. Not much has changed. Probably the richness has changed, or the certain words that are used more predominantly back then have changed. Whereas if you grab a poet from the 15th century and compare him to you know, Instagram work right now of, you know, my poetry, they're like, what is going on here? It's a whole different, you know, type of poetry, a whole different, you know, use of poetry. The language is different, the form is different. So somebody has to realize poetry changes perhaps every century. I think that is the window where poetry dramatically changes. And we're in the era of, you know, more contemporary work where people have broken free from form. But in 100 years, people are going to evaluate that and critique that as a form of poetry that has its time and its place. So in order for somebody to learn, they have to understand English poetry has periods. So they select a starting point, understand what changed between that starting point and the next, and why it was an improvement. So sometimes you find from before the Romantic era to the Romantic era, the improvement was the imagery, the type of metaphors, the use of language to describe nature that didn't exist before. So they had 100 years of learning, and that's what the takeaway is. So you don't have to, you know, live for 1,000 years to understand those improvements. So in order for you to bet your work, you have to see Shakespeare, you have to read Shakespeare, you have to read the more, you know, the Keats, and understand what happened in that period. And once you understand what happened in that period, you will know how we reach the contemporary era of poetry. And once you're in the contemporary era of poetry, you'll understand where you fit in. And that's the most important part. So you'll be able to read poets that are quite similar to you in terms of sphere and be able to learn from what they've done differently. So reading, but also understanding, you know, the context is very important, because I've had a person, you know, get stuck in the Shakespeare era and then decide to mimic Shakespearean poetry, not knowing there isn't much of a space for it, despite its beauty. So he could be the next Shakespeare, but because he's living in 2024, nobody's going to realize.
Right.
So there is a time and place, unfortunately. And the same thing can be said for individual poetic devices, from rhyme to everything you can imagine. So understanding what to learn will save this person a lot of time. So understanding that poetry is fluid and changes will also save this person learning a lot of time.
Yeah, and you've been talking about, you know, like poetry changing every 100 years, and like innovation within poetry and being able to drive innovation once you've mastered English poetry. I guess a question around that, like, how do you see like, you know, a lot of the contemporary poets are coming from, there's this theme, you know, coming from different backgrounds into the Western world, speaking a lot about, you know, that journey, those mixed identities. So where, how do you see our different cultures impacting the future of English poetry, and whether it be in terms of the content or the forms, where do you see this going?
I think the impact is already present. We've reached a stage in 2024 where, you know, the poetry coming from the diaspora is probably the most profound. It's partly because it has human experiences that the reader cannot tap into naturally. So it's driven by that. But it's also because of, like I said, and what we mentioned before, the cultural and lingual heritage that these poets are able to weaponize in their poetry. That's what a lot of people are not discussing, and that's what will be discussed in academic circles in 50, 30 year times, and 30 years' time or 50 years' time. Is that is what the real driver is they can bring a beauty that hasn't been seen in the English language, a way of describing, a way of explaining emotive language, metaphors that haven't really been expressed before in English poetry. And that is what really drives the growth of English poetry and the development of English poetry. And thankfully, a lot of us have heritage that we could weaponize. It's just how you weaponize that heritage in poetry. It's what eventually will change English poetry for the best. I think we are in a very lucky place. It's kind of an infancy of an infancy where we could potentially add things to a language while being almost native tongues of the English language. So don't forget, English changes, English generally changes when immigration happens over a course of centuries. But this is the first time in history that you have first, second, third generation, you know, immigrants who have mastered the English language, and not just mastered the English language, are carrying second and third languages and using it to create discourse within, you know, literary work. So eventually our kids will not master a second or third language as well as us. So that will filter away. So this window of, you know, perhaps half a century is going to be quite unique when we look, you know, look back on it. When we're dead and buried, when they look back on it, they'll be like this flurry of, you know, secondary, third cultures that have come in and have had an impact on the works and poetry of the English language. And it's not just language, it's also religion. And that's what got discussed as well, is I've had discussions in academic circles and in, you know, normal places where poets you know, create workshops and discussions, and inspiration and motivation is the biggest Achilles heel. That's most poets struggle with inspiration and writer's block. And I told them about the kind of, you know, Ahlul Bayt system that we have, where we have a kind of subconscious calendar running in the back of our mind. And they found the idea so fascinating. I was like, yeah, it's like a, you know, an automated calendar where we as a community not only mourn and celebrate, but also innovate and create based on this timeline. And that forces creativity, even when a person is lacking that creativity. And even when they are, you know, finding no way of potentially writing, they are engrossed in an environment that is rich in poetry. And
Right.
that is unique to us, and is something that is going to help our poetic craft moving forward, which other communities won't be able to tap into.
No, that's very interesting. I mean, that's yeah, a culture has such an impact on the way we present poetry, especially when it comes to the Ahlul Bayt. And you know, in regards to culture, I wanted to ask you in regards to how English poetry is perceived in the Arab culture, because you know, we the guests that we've had up until now, it's just based on coincidence. They've all been, you know, kind of from like a South Asian background, Urdu speaking. That's where we are, our background is. So we kind of have an idea in regards to our culture as to how English poetry is perceived. Alhamdulillah, it's gone a long way, I believe. Like it's or maybe it's on the journey of being more accepted. And that has to do a lot with English lectures as well. I think, you know, when our speakers started speaking in English, you know, a lot of even us guys growing up here, because we were always exposed to lectures in our mother tongue. And so when we started hearing English lectures, even us being born and raised here, we're like, oh, what's this? This doesn't feel right. But now, with the kind of the process and more English lectures happening, you know, the growth of English lectures have assisted in poetry and the Ahlul Bayt being accepted, at least in our culture. So I just wanted to touch base in regards to your Arab culture. How has it been perceived in your culture? And you know, is there a level of acceptance right now, or is that still a jihad-e Akbar that's going on right now?
Our experiment started probably 16, 17 years ago. So we started experimenting with English poetry a long time before a lot of the other Western communities even attempted to begin to recite and English poetry or develop English poetry. And it started off, you know, accidental. A lot of poets were passionate about the English poetry, and it was their creative outlet. I can't write Arabic poetry to save my life, so this was my, you know, saving grace. But like many other Western cultures, the first reaction is almost that's cute, but also a back of my subconscious disgust, like how, you know, weird and simplistic this is, and we'll put it out on the back burner and leave it as a kind of a side hobby for our youth. But we've reached a stage where organically, obviously, the youth that were once young and appreciative became organizers of these communities and leaders of these communities. So naturally, there is that bias. But then there also, you know, over the course of time, an appreciation was created because they realized this poetry was distinctly different. I think that is where the struggle happens, is when you try to create mirror images of something, the comparisons are almost direct. So if you try to create, you know, English poetry, you know, identical forms of English poetry to say Arabic, then naturally there's going to be a comparison, even from an untrained ear, let alone a trained, you know, adult, an elder. So once that distinction was created naturally, it wasn't intentional, but we saw the appreciation of English poetry didn't, you know, organically give in and rise. So I have sympathies for communities, and I've discussed this with a few other communities across the world where they want to drive English poetry, but there is no support. And best way, unfortunately, is to kind of drive it as a poet. Not wait for that appreciation from the organizers or the community, is to drive it. And the best way to drive something is to master. Mastery is, for me, and I can get into it, that there is a poem and there is a poet. And I've said this speech a couple of times, and you're gonna have to forgive me for rambling on, but I think this is quite important.
No, please.
So I'm a firm believer that every one of us has a poem inside them, no matter how competent you are at writing. I think we're naturally gifted as human beings, due to our kind of divine nature as humans, to have a poem within us. And that's why over the course of history, you've seen immortalized poems, and you're like, wait a second, let me read about this poet. And you find that he's only got a single poem. And you're like, what happened here? And that was always a question in the back of my mind. Sometimes you find a poem that is as unique, as beautiful, even more beautiful than what an established poet could write. And that's the beauty of us all having a poem within us. But then on the other side of the table, you have the poets. The poets are people that can harness this energy quite readily. And the only way to perfect this craft is the mastery over it. But when a poet thinks that because they had a beautiful poem within them, that they could replicate that without mastery, that's when it becomes an issue. Because they've seen the production and the birth of this poem, and they assume it's going to come again. They just have to wait. In Arabic, we have al-ilm, which means knowledge, and al-ilm al-ludni, which means the knowledge from within. So this divine essence. And I'm a firm believer that a poem is the combination of both, and it's the building of both pieces of knowledge. And that's why when I got into poetry translation, when I was a judge for the Stephen Spender Prize, I discovered that, it's quite evident that poetry, every poem that exists in every single language, has a poetic essence, like a soul. So no matter what you do to the literal framework of the poem, it does not change. A soul exists. You can beautify the soul and essence, but that is the most important thing, and that's a divinely inspired thing. And as poets, you have to master your craft so you could have the building blocks to beautify and expand and elevate this poetic essence that everybody has within them. So that is a distinction I've made, and I think poets that want to better their community from a poetic standpoint should understand this, that in order to do it, you should, seek and pursue mastery. And once you seek and pursue mastery, people will see that you are, even if they don't like your work. I know a lot of people that don't like poetry. Let's not get it twisted. Most people don't like poetry. But if they see a perfection, just like if I see an artist and I don't like their, abstract style, but I see their mastery, I appreciate their mastery. Even when I speak to them, when they explain the reasoning behind their selection, that is awe-inspiring. So there needs to be a level of respect. Poetry in certain communities needs to go from, without Sanders wrote, child play to mastery. And then that builds the respect of the community. And we are naturally progressing, and there's timelines across different parts of different countries. And, England just happens to be ahead in the timeline, and that's all it is. And that's because, something happened, and you know what, how timelines work, some sort of inception, and it caused the timeline to accelerate ahead of perhaps America or Canada.
Mashallah, before you ask your question, Naki, I don't know if you're noticing this, but we're speaking of poetry, and right now this the image we're seeing from Brother Tahir is very poetic. Like, there's this glare and this shadow next to him. It's like you can write a poem just on that right now.
Nature's poetry.
For some odd reason, you've caught England in a very interesting time. We've got stuck for once instead of overcast.
Mashallah.
Clouds, yeah. So
I did have a follow-up, Tahir, on the point you've been mentioning around like the acceptance within the communities. And something we've kind of talked about as well from before, around like growing that community, growing your readership, your listeners, to be able to grow with you as a poet as you master the language, right? And I think like just my observation, I feel like English, within English culture and English societies, poetry has not reached that wide acceptance as much as it has in many other cultures, like for example, in the Arab world or South Asian world or Persian, like where poetry is just part of society, right? Like people know like lines of poetry by heart. They use it in their everyday language, right? And maybe in the English language in general, it has never reached that level. So, and you mentioned yourself, most people don't really like poetry, right? So I guess
It's
I'm
not
building this
part
stuff
of
up. Yeah.
it's not part of the fabric of our
Of our
societies.
society, yeah.
And poetry is something that is, it's considered cute in a way. You've written some poetry, well done. But whereas, poet in the Arab world, it's like those are survey. Sorry to interrupt. Survey in the Arab world, where all the countries were surveyed, the kids. So this is a modern generation that has exposed to TikTok and YouTube and whatnot. What is your favorite potential job? If you ask a kid in London, he'd say a fireman or a policeman or the Hulk. But a kid in the Arab world, their favored future job is being a poet. literally across the whole.
But
And I think that extends to different parts of the world, not just the Arabic world, but that shows you the power of poetry. That even a child that hasn't been exposed to poetry as much as an adult is exposed enough to value it. And that will forever be a problem for us. And that's why I've always said, when it comes to, I get the question of how do we kind of grow our poetic following is focus on people that would understand and grow with you as an audience and a reader, because that's where English is quite unique in that sense, because you need to develop poetry readers in this language, whereas in the other languages, they're born poetry readers, if that makes sense. It's almost like a gift where you are not just a writer, you're either a writer or a listener or both. Where you have that appreciation, where it touches you, the very essence of your soul, just simply listening to poetry. But you say, you read a poem out loud in the middle of, Oxford Street in London, nobody's gonna bat a second eyelid.
They're
But
gonna
that is,
think you're crazy.
they'll think you're crazy. But that is a challenge and the beauty of the English language, because it's so malleable, you could eventually do something about it in your very own way, even though it's, very microevolution level. But that is a challenge that we've always got, we've always faced and we will always face, I think.
Yeah, and I guess like one of the challenges I have noticed is like at least a little bit more than Urdu, or that's the language I know. But one thing I noticed with English poetry is you do need to know a little bit more about like the poetic techniques and different devices that are being used to be able to appreciate a little bit more. And maybe that's just because the prosody of the English, I mean Urdu language, where it's just like everything is based on a specific meter, and it sounds better, and you don't need to know the details of it as much, or the technical side of it as much as English. How do we build that readership? Or even if it's not readership, let's take it to the communities. How can we build an audience where they are able to appreciate as we master the language? Is it just based on listening to us grow and then being able to introduce these different technical devices? I guess how does that work? And maybe from your experience, I know you have grown an audience as well that really appreciates your work.
So for me, there is no straightforward answer. I've always said, as long as you are constantly elevating your own poetry, your readership will elevate with you, because it's at the end of the day, it's an educational experience for both of you. And also, I've discussed this to the point of headache with you, okay, poetic voice here. It's you are not just drumming this poetic education, vicariously, but you're also creating a unique poetic voice where it's a blueprint, a trademark, where eventually, subconsciously, they appreciate that type of poetry. So when you recreate another poem in a similar manner to something you created a year ago, subconsciously, there's a ticking situation happening in their brain where they're like, I like this, but I don't know why I like this. But it's similar to something you've created before. And you could experiment with this in different ways, whether it's creating series or repeating imagery or metaphors, or perhaps replicating the entire form with a different topic. But it's at the end of the day, it is a bilateral relationship you have with your readership. And that's something previous generation of poets didn't have, where we have that instantaneous kind of feedback, not just feedback, appreciation as well, from people that read your poems almost instantly. As previously, poets used to have to die to be published. Now it, yeah. So how we harness this new piece of technology is the question. And things, and I've always said, take things lightly and subtly, because you could go create the same way people came into the English language and said, you know what, it's so bad, I'm going to bring in all this Arabic into it, and then ruined it with the creation, and ended up with poetry that hasn't been remembered. Same thing with tech. You could go batshit crazy and do all sorts, but is it upending your own, development? That's the question that we should always be asking. But at the end of the day, poetry is a personal thing, and as long as you're personally enjoying the process, that is what matters. And There shouldn't be any stagnation. That's another thing that I'm very adamant about. There should always be room for growth because you've taken up a language that is in need of growth.
Wow.
You are, yeah, so if you write in Arabic, there are certain levels where you know you've hit the peak because your work begins to be compared with certain poets. But there are standards in English poetry, especially when we're writing about the Ahlul Bayt or Islamic topics. There are no standards because the standards are constantly being created. And that's where stagnation can happen, is because you see yourself as, at the end of the day, there are, let's say, 15 poets in the English language, and that's probably a stretch. I don't think there are 15 English poets in our community, as in that write about the Ahlul Bayt. So naturally, the standards, no matter how great these poets are quite low and ever evolving. So one has to constantly not challenge himself against the other poets, but against himself, and know that this is an open goal where whatever we create today will enforce the type of poetry that comes after us and is able to eclipse us because we've given them the, you know,
The
the,
limit.
yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, we don't, at the moment, we don't really have limits. And
Yeah.
again, it's a good thing, but also a terribly bad thing because stagnation can take hold.
Yeah.
That's where mastery is very important because you also need a direction. Without mastery, you don't know what direction you're evolving in. So these are unique experiences again to people of cult, you know, rich cultural backgrounds and rich religious backgrounds, especially you know, I think there probably is a few studies about the, you know, the poetic influence of Karbala and the Ahlul Bayt, but it is something to be studied, I think, more because it is, I never experienced anything speaking to poetic poet peers like the power and the magnetism of the Ahlul Bayt when it comes to poetry.
Yeah.
And that is a driver that not a lot of people appreciate as much. You know, we are, as poets, obviously appreciate, but to realize that you could harness the power of your own faith to create, that is a whole world that, you know, that other people can't really access. And people wait for talent like they wait for chocolates, and they wait for inspiration like they wait for, you know, the passing of the weather. But in reality, it's right there in front of you.
Yeah.
So we should, you know, reach out and take it.
Let's go inside your mind a little bit, Brother Tahir. Mashallah, we've had a pretty deep conversation about growth and language and cultures and mastering poetry and not allowing ourselves to grow, etc. But let's get inside your mind a little bit here. I want to know your process when it comes to writing a poem. Like, for example, right now you shared your poem about Karbala to start this episode. But I mean, that's just an example. You don't have to use that specific poem if you like. But what's your process? Like, let's say that you intend to write a poem. Guide us through your process. Like, why would you select a certain metaphor? How do you filter out certain thoughts? Do you write it down first and then you present in a poem? Just explain your process. I know a magician doesn't share all his tricks, but if you can kind of let us know a little bit inside your brain, so just as a guide, to some of the people who are listening who want to write poetry, give us the Tahir Adil process from A to Z if you can.
Definitely not a magician, because a magician knows how things are done. What I can tell you is a lot of it is sporadic naturally. Creative energy is, you know, the brain firing different neurons, and then you've got, you know, ilm al-ludni, the internal, not you know, divine knowledge that we are all blessed with, and it's all going on at the same time. It's kind of, you know, creative energy is, it's like we all have ADHD at the same time, and it's stabilizing yourself and, you know, grabbing these complex notions, and these inspirational notions, and piecing them together. And for me, the best way over the years has been to kind of sit down, make time and space for yourself without distractions, and focusing on the essence of the poem, understanding that I've discussed this a lot. There's many ways of creating a poem. You could create a poem through words, you know, a sequence of words where you've said, oh, these words are perfect. I want them to be part of a poem. And building around words, that is one way. Then you've also got the idea. Sometimes you're like, today is the birth of the prophet. I want to write about the birth of the prophet. So now you are faced with an idea in front of you before a poem is formed. That is a second way that, you know, naturally people, you know, begin to write their poetry. But I think the most powerful way to write a poem is to capture the actual essence of the poem to begin with. And I've managed to do that through, you know, we all know the process of free writing. And then finding sequences and patterns within that to say, you know what, this isn't going to be the poem that I'm going to write, but there is something here that I want to explore in a poem. And for me, a lot of my work has revolved around this process of capturing, and it could be two, three lines, where it's not because they're aesthetically pleasing, because they can become aesthetically pleasing later on, because I've always described a poem as kind of a clay structure. It doesn't need to be beautiful during the conception of the poem, but it does need to have a soul. And for me, like the Karbala's poets, you know, the soul of the poet, the poem was, the poem was in the place of the flag. And we had to dip our pens in ink the same way Abbas had to dip his hands in water. That was the essence of the poem, but it ended up only being a line and a half of the poem itself, but that built what we ended up reading. So a lot of it is diving in and reflection. Many of us don't realize poetry is one of the greatest forms of reflection, and we all know, you know, the profound nature of reflection, even outside the scopes of religion. Within religion itself, we know, you know, how powerful and how rewarding reflection can be for the mind, for the soul, and our trajectories as human beings. But if you use poetry as a reflective exercise, you're kind of doing two birds with one stone. You don't need a poem to come out of this, but you could harness your own talent and will, you know, drive to write poetry to also reflect. So that has been my way of writing, but within there are complexities, and I probably, you know, like he's gone through with these. You know, there are complexities even within metaphors and the choice of metaphors.
We need
And
its own episode just for those complexities, bro.
yeah, so as a lot of people don't realize the power of the different senses that we have, and how you harness these type of senses within the imagery you're creating. We are often, you know, deluded in thinking that imagery is just visual, but imagery is more than, you know, you are there and placed to capture multiple senses at the same time, and you could play with all those senses in poetry. And yeah, so there are different aspects within the writing process that will take ages to go through, but there is no, you know, blueprint. And I think that makes it exciting for me, because I could be on, you know, a train one day or on a plane one day, and in my mind there's a beautiful image that I want to capture in words, and that could be the start of the process. Or it could be the exploration of language, which I've done with the Arabic language, where it's the pursuit of knowledge that is driving the poetry and the pursuit of understanding. So, and I think a lot of poets, if you ask, and I'm sure if you ask yourselves that question, is there is no answers, and we can become more effective in a certain way when we, you know, play a game in the background, or sit next to the window. We can, you know, be more effective poets, I suppose. But the drive is really the inspiration and capturing the essence. It's like English, and that's, I suppose, the difference between the English language and other languages, where I describe it as like fishing in a lake in comparison with fishing in an ocean, where there is very limited, you know, water, and a body of water, and your tools are very primitive, but you could still create a swan lake that is, you know, more beautiful than a, you know, a crashing ocean in a
Right.
certain
Yeah.
image. And it's also the, you know, like taking a photograph of a lake itself. If you know, if you take a correct, beautiful angle, you can make it more beautiful than taking a beach photo, I suppose. And that's playing with the constraints and restrictions. Restrictions aren't necessarily bad things because they allow you to improve, and they allow you to innovate. Because don't forget, when somebody's writing in Urdu or Farsi or Arabic, they have natural teachers without seeking a mentor, because they just need to read. Whereas with English, you are not only the student, but you're also the teacher, because you are practically both at the same time. If you're writing English poetry, you are innovating and learning at the same time. And I think that is something that we should all be conscious of.
I guess
MashaAllah.
like going off of that, a lot of the listeners that we have are people who want to get into English poetry writing poetry in English for the Ahlul Bayt in particular, but in generally harnessing and improving their craft. What are three tips that you would give to poets who are starting off or want to write more or improve their writing?
Oh, we've gone through a lot of tips indirectly, I feel, but something that we haven't discussed before, it's don't focus on your social media or appreciation to start off with. If you are at the very beginning of your journey, focus on the poems themselves. Focus on taking time out of your day to read other poets, not necessarily within the same genre or themes. But exploring, you know, sometimes finding a poet that writes about ducks is fascinating, not because ducks are fascinating, but because you're like, how the hell has he managed to describe ducks in a certain way? And there's a lesson in that. There's an absolute lesson in that. So taking time out of it. And I've always been part of the camp where I don't like reading poetry as much as I write poetry. I've changed that in the last couple of years for my own sake, but you have to realize sometimes you don't need to like it to use it, and sometimes it's a necessity. So I'd say begin master. There's no, you know, mastery is a forever journey. Nobody's going to become a master of their craft, but the beauty of it is that you continue to press and learn. Don't see it as a given. You know, you always find poets, especially within the English language, especially when writing about the Ahlul Bayt, that have come across this profound metaphor that they've created, and it's brilliant, it's absolutely brilliant, but have used it in their first poem and assumed everything else will come to them the same way that original. And that's where I made the distinction between the poet and the poem. You could be a writer of a poem and beautify this poem and immortalize this poem. But do you want to be a poet as well? And that is a question a lot of people to ask themselves. If they do want to become a poet, then they need to master the craft. And in order to master the craft of poetry in for the Ahlul Bayt, they have to master the craft of the language they're using. And in order to master the craft of the language, they have to deep, you know, dive deep into things that they might not necessarily want to do or have time to do. So yeah, those are things that, you know, early poets should identify. If it's a poet that has been writing for a while, perhaps think about things to innovate with. Every poet is unique naturally, but English language more so, where your uniqueness needs to be quite, you know, explicit, because with other languages like Arabic, there comes a time where an Arabic style of poetry is used, and it kind of supersedes the poets. So you're like, I want to read this type of Arabic poetry, and then you read this type of Arabic poetry that has six different types, six different poets. Whereas English, unfortunately, the poet comes first. So in order for people to read that specific type of poetry, they have to read a specific poet. So you need to kind of stand out but it doesn't mean changing your way of poetry. It can mean a replication of your own work sometimes. It's establishing a poetic voice. Sometimes, the funniest things can happen when it comes to being memorable is just doing more of what you're already doing, not necessarily changing it. I think the biggest fear people have is that they are seen as kind of a replication of somebody else, which isn't a bad thing. But sometimes, doubling down on what you're doing is actually what is needed as a developing poet. The third thing I would advise is seeking avenues outside of your sphere. So whether it's taking your page poetry into spoken form, and that's another unique thing about the English language, is that those two forms are quite distinct and different. So maybe exploring spoken word form will be something that you're better at, so you can double down on spoken poetry. Or what you'll find is dabbling in spoken word can better your page poetry, and vice versa. With other languages like Farsi and Arabic, where almost every page poem is made to be read out loud. It's like, a symbiosis almost. So that distinction doesn't exist. So harness the uniqueness of the English language and work out where it's unique and where it can be improved. And, don't be under the illusion that the English language is great either. You get certain posts, I think it's the next best thing since sliced bread, and it's not. So understanding those restrictions and constraints are quite important.
Well, I think that, we can talk about this for hours, about poetry, and it's such an ocean of knowledge when it comes to poetry, especially about English poetry. And like I said, we've touched based on certain topics, and these topics need its own episode. But for our viewers, I think, like we said, this is a poetry podcast. So I think at this point, we've had a lot to talk about. I know I've been inspired just from this conversation to write, just based on the topics that we've had the honor to listen to. But I think at this point, like I mentioned, we started off with a poem. I think this is a good opportunity now to kind of close off this episode with with another poem. So, with Tahir, like I mentioned, we're gonna sandwich this episode with a poem to start and poem to end. So please, if you can share another piece of your another beautiful poem of yours, that would be great right now.
Oh, let me have a look. Okay, so this is page two of my first collection, Lost and Found, and it's a poem from 2015. And it's titled God in Words. Everywhere I look, each path I take, each road I pass, I see the signs perfectly designed by the words of God. In gills that breathe ocean deep and wings aloft like silken dreams, the scent of flowery, beauteous worth inked upon the body of his earth. And when I gaze back into my eyes, I see two panels of stained glass. Inside, a thousand worlds wander by like leaves falling upon a winter's sigh, a repetitive sunset in a summer sky against a backdrop of deep crimson milk upon spherical shores, seas of milk. My eyes tell a tale of a craftsman of superior skill, a hand precise, bringing fire to the minute details of noon, to the silver lines of a rising moon traced out upon galaxies in darkness lost, birthing stars like breaths of autumn frost. Even in death, we see him write. Just as he turns dark to light, to life from gloom, then the promise of blossom and flowers return to bloom. But the greatest miracle of them all is drawn out upon the tapestry of the soul. Woven by light and a breath of life, a bodiless form he placed inside. To move, to think, to love, then die, so that he may yet ask, which of the signs of your Lord will you deny? And that is a poem
Wow.
titled God in
Beautiful
Words.
poem.
MashaAllah,
I
that was
love that
amazing.
ending there.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. MashaAllah. Well, this does conclude our episode here today of another episode here of the Pulse of the Household podcast. Naki, anything you'd like to add before we end off?
No, just to thank Tahir for his time, and it was a huge learning experience, just this entire podcast episode, listening to your discussion.
MashaAllah, like from a personal standpoint, you know, a poet doesn't only try to better himself but or herself, but the true, I would say, sign of a poet is when they better others as well. And I know that from a personal standpoint, Naki and I have spoken about this. I've known Naki for a while, for like a long time, and I've seen kind of his natural progression of poetry, and I've told him I've seen the way he has improved. And that has a lot to do with yourself, Brother Tahir, your relationship with him. And mashallah, like it shows. Not only mashallah are you a master of poetry, but you are a master of teaching poetry. And you have one of your pupils here, one of your students here, Brother
I wouldn't call him a peer. He's more, I learned more from him naturally. He
Naki.
just accommodated, he allowed me time to speak and communicate and ramble on.
Humble too. He's humble too.
Which has been great for both of us. I think communication, planting seeds of communication, especially amongst poets, is necessary for growth. And like I said, we are all learning. We are all masters, teachers, as well as students at the same time, because of where we are in the language that we're practicing our poetry in. So I'm absolutely honored to, you know, be invited to plant more seeds of discussions, hopefully that we can take on and discuss in person, or
So.
on podcasts or episodes. But you know, it was my honor to, you know, be a student of Naki,
Come
and help him.
on, man.
You know, help him find the discussion points within his own poetry.
It's amazing. That's amazing. Yeah, I've seen, like I said, I've seen the improvement in him, and that's kudos to yourself and of course his thirst for learning as well. So,
I guess,
mashallah.
Dyer, did you want to give a plug for anything before we end?
Yeah.
No plug. If you want to read poetry books, there's a few. They don't show. That's my plug. So
MashaAllah.
there's, yeah, Lost and Found, I Don't Know What Language I Dream In, The Names, The Chosen Names, and The Divine Names. And depending on the names you like, you could, you know, read the books you like. Some people like more names than others. So those are explorations of English poetry in conversation with the Arabic poetry, but it has a deeper layer, whether it's the divine names being the names of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, being the names of the Ahlul Bayt and the chosen names, and the names being the names of everything mundane like the moon in comparison to the Ahlul Bayt. And that
MashaAllah.
is the third iteration of the collection.
That's amazing. That's amazing. So this does conclude our episode, another episode of the Pulse of the Household podcast. Thank you so much for joining us, Brother Tahir Adel. Inshallah, this will be one of many discussions. We will have you back. As I mentioned, this was probably just an intro. There's a lot more to dissect within these conversations, and inshallah, we will invite you back. To our viewers, to our listeners, thank you so much for being with us here today, and please join us on the next episode of the Poets of the Household podcast. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.